The title of is The Simple Truth About AIDS, Living with HIV Infection in the Church. The format will be, I'm going to do a little introductory kinds of remarks, and then each of us will share our experience about how it is to be dealing with HIV infection in as members of the church or former members of the church or somehow affiliated with the Mormon Church. As I left to come to this symposium, one of my colleagues at the Utah AIDS Foundation said, "What are you doing?" I said, "Well, I'm going down to talk about the response of the church to AIDS." And he said, "Well, was that going to be a moment of silence?" And naturally, some people will agree with that, and some people may not. And I think that our object here is to perhaps not necessarily criticize what hasn't happened, but what should happen and the experiences that we might have. One of the things that most of the panelists, and one of our panelists isn't here because hopefully she'll show up before the end. She took her family. She's a single mother now as her husband died from AIDS in March. And she has six children, and they went on a ward outing to Bear Lake, and she wasn't sure what time they were going to be able to come back. But if she doesn't show up, she has given me the liberty to share some of her story and some of her experiences. By way of introduction, I'll introduce myself since no one else is going to. I'll introduce Barb and Susan Ann, the regular things. It's very interesting. I am a convert to the church. So I was a born-again Christian before, so I am a born-again Christian Mormon, which is interesting, but also keeps me sane. I am the president of the Board of Trustees of the Utah AIDS Foundation. I am also an active member of the church. And a lot of all those things, for some people, that's a lot of what Dr. Ritchie talked about, this: how can you balance all the paradoxes and the contradictions of your life? Well, I happen to believe that my Christianity came a lot from the Book of Mormon, interestingly enough, and that the Savior paid the price for all of the contradictions that we are, and that I don't have to worry about those contradictions because the judgment and the experience that I've had with the Lord only enhance my ability to live within the contradictions that I am, and ultimately only He has the right to judge anyone. My background is I grew up in rural Nevada and escaped when I was, as soon as I could, out of high school, and went to the University of Washington State University in Pullman, Washington, and joined the church there as a freshman in college. I then, my sophomore year, I went to BYU. I then went on a mission to Mexico, came back, worked in Colorado in migrant health. My love and my background is nutrition. I attended my graduate studies at the University of California at Berkeley, worked in South Carolina a few years, lived in Guatemala, Chile, Ecuador, at various other places. I really, my heart would like to be in the symposium a couple of doors down where Tim Evans is leading a discussion about how should we be dealing with people who are in poverty. And my whole life has been about ending hunger in the world. I was recruited and came to be a member of the faculty of Brigham Young University in 1980. One of the most difficult things I ever did was having been called to this thing that I didn't necessarily want to do, but you just do what you feel you need to do. And so I joined the faculty of BYU in 1980 and left in 1985 and have been a member of the faculty at the University of Utah. And and work for the state of Utah in health. My background is in public health. My experience is in public health nutrition. I'm a dietitian and nutritionist, one of those kinds of people. And a few years ago, I have been involved with HIV infection because I happen to be a person who has HIV infection, and I'll share that part of my life later. So I have all these interesting, I have an interesting life. I mean, I have a lot of background. I think this is my third life, actually. But why is it important that members of the church who would rather not deal with HIV infection learn to deal with it? And that's the kind of the purpose of coming here. And why is it that I, as an active member of the church, my stake president called me before he found out I was doing, well, I told him I was. I always clear things with him. But so I'm doing this thing at Sunset Symposium. He said, just be careful, you know, you don't. And actually, my testimony's been fortified from being here. I mean, that's not a contradiction when truth is truth. And this wonderful thing about the history of the church. So my experience with the Lord is not all linear. And things happen, and so the history was changed a little bit. That doesn't matter. I mean, it only has fortified my testimony to be with people who are willing to tell the truth. And so the title of this is The Simple Truth About AIDS. Now, a couple of things. How many of you have had what I would consider AIDS 101, that you know what the disease is, what the pathology is, what the virus is, what it does, etc.? How many? Okay, so we're talking to people who have had that part. Because sometimes we talk to people and, like, they don't know the first thing about it. If you don't, if you're curious, we're going to have lots of time, hopefully, for questions. So we won't need to talk about what HIV infection is. What it is a disaster that is plaguing humankind. And the one thing that some of us have in common, actually all of us, is that under the direction of my stake president, I live in the Salt Lake stake, Paul Hanks is my stake president, and under his, from my working with him and becoming active again in the church and jumping through all the necessary hoops in order to make that happen, and recognizing, coming to that space of that nothing changes when people pound from without, but people change when their hearts are touched from within. And so consequently, I and a group of other people who are affected by HIV infection have a support group. And that support group is under the direction of the regional representative, Brother Peterson, with the full knowledge and blessings of I'm the area presidency for the Salt Lake Central area. Now, lots of people don't know that. This support group meets the second Sunday of every month currently. And if enough people feel like it's okay to come and be there, the thing is open. And the whole intent was that anyone who is affected by, they don't have to have HIV infection, but affected by, and that should include practically everyone, in the world at this point, particularly those who have loved ones, family, friends, etc., should come there and be able to talk about it and be able to meet in a comfortable place, should be able to meet in a setting that culturally is appropriate for them. The support groups that we have at the Utah AIDS Foundation, for some people that would be real scary for them to come and be in a setting where most of the people are HIV infected. And just because of the epidemic, the epidemiology of HIV infection in the United States, it happens to be among homosexual men, and so that whole thing happens. And at that point, I'm going to read a statement that I wrote for a couple of us gave a seminar for all of the stake presidents and the bishops in a couple of stakes in Salt Lake. And as part of that, I wrote this little thing about why we need to know about HIV infection. The virus known as immunodeficiency virus, or HIV, has become a powerful force in the world. Some have asked why would it be important for a righteous people to know about such a thing. Many church members feel that it will not ever affect them. Perhaps it will not. It is possible that their immediate family will not be affected. If we live, quote-unquote, pure and virtuous lives, if we abstain from sexual relations outside of marriage and marry only people who have lived lives where they have not been exposed, not likely, then perhaps HIV will never touch us. However, because of the magnitude of the problem, it is unlikely that we will never have to deal with anyone who is affected with the virus or have something to do with somebody who will. It is estimated that there are currently, and the estimations run from a low of 10 million people in the world to a high of 100 million people in the world who have HIV infection. Recent data indicates that every 13 seconds, a new infection incurs. Just from that evidence alone, it is clear that HIV is not something that is going away. In the last days, we are promised that there will be plagues upon the earth. It appears that this indeed is a plague, and as human beings and ministers of the Lord, we will need to decide our response. The moral and spiritual dilemma of AIDS. Not in recent history has the disease affected humanity with more opportunity for introspection than AIDS. In the United States, the disease first appeared among the population of homosexual men. Because it is a sexually transmitted disease, it spread rapidly among the sexually active. The majority of society, having been indoctrinated with the perception that same-sex attraction is evil, quickly saw AIDS as a curse deserved by those evil people for their perversion. It is now evident that HIV infection is not a disease limited to the minority of human beings who are homosexual, but rather a plague that is threatening entire populations of human beings on the planet Earth. A particular problem that has come up is one of confused bigotry. It appears that because AIDS began in the United States among homosexuals, there are many people who cannot separate the disease from the affliction that they call homosexuality. This is making it particularly difficult for some Christian churches, and not excluding the LDS Church, to learn to deal in a compassionate way with people with HIV infection. For some people, the reality of AIDS in their lives, either by family or friends, has forced them to reevaluate their feelings. While the teachings of the church and adherence to standards will protect our people from infection, it is important to remember that we are a growing and expanding church. It is likely that some new converts will already be infected, which makes it even more important to have a basic understanding of the virus and the disease that results from the infection. For example, missionaries, should we preach the gospel in Africa, who work in Africa will have to know how to deal with HIV infection if they are to be effective in their work. In some African nations, as many as 50% of all men and women and children are infected. We have an opportunity to be a light in a place of darkness for millions of people. We have an opportunity to share the restored gospel and the healing message of the Lord Jesus Christ to our brothers and sisters who have HIV infection. Rather than seeing HIV infection as something to stay away from, perhaps we can look to the example of the Master and his showing us the way. His ministry was always to the sick and afflicted, the outcast, and the feared. We, too, can follow in his footsteps. And that's what essentially the context of my... I feel like the work that I'm doing is a ministry. And when I was asked to be president of the Board of Trustees of the Utah AIDS Foundation, there's a contradiction. How can you do that when we're preaching about... I say, well, because what's right is right, and we need to do things because they're right, not because they are prudent or whatever else anybody might say, and that truth ultimately prevails, and that the contradictions of my life are mine, and I have an opportunity to give them away to a person, a Savior, who actually heals and has blessed my life. And at this time, I'm going to turn the time over to Susan Ann Stauffer. Susan Ann is... a Relief Society president, and a unique Relief Society president in lots of ways, but probably among the best Relief Society presidents that her ward could possibly ever have. Susan Ann is a unique person. She has two children. That's not unique. Maybe it is, because, you know, sometimes people in this church have 5 or 10. But she has one son who just came home from a mission in the Philippines, and she has a daughter, and... Susan Ann received her bachelor's in university studies at the University of Utah in modern dance and exercise and sports science. And the really interesting thing about Susan Ann is that in 1991, she graduated with her BS in 1991, and she was the valedictorian of her class at the University of Utah in 1991. I have experienced, my interaction with Susan Ann has been in the context of both HIV infection and in ending hunger in the world, and I have found her to have incredible insight and compassion, and I'm anxious to see what she has prepared for us. The other night at 2:30, we were talking on the phone, so I know she's prepared.
Well, maybe one of these days I will not be frightened doing this sort of thing. After listening to him talk, I kind of have a paper prepared, and I thought, I mean, I've been working on courage the last couple of years in my life to just be able to stand up and talk and say what I really feel, and that's real hard. So I kind of had a paper written. I was going to say a lot of things. He said that we were going to talk about things that we want to do rather than things that have happened, and there's quite a few things in my paper about things that have happened. So if you'll bear with me, I'm just going to kind of try and talk to you for a minute here. I am meeting on the Sunday night group with these people, and I think it's curious that I am here at Sunstone talking on a panel about HIV, because it would not be the thing that I would have ever thought that I would be here talking about. In fact, I was just thinking the other day that in a stress management class probably 4 or 5 years ago at the university, we were supposed to list on a set of values, you know, to put them in a hierarchical order. And one of those values was social conscience. And a couple of months ago, I was looking through those papers, and do you know where social conscience was? On my list, it was like 19th, and I thought, you know, I wonder if I even knew what social conscience meant. I think I thought it meant manners or something. Because that is so opposite to where I am now, and it seems like there was something that happened to me a couple of years ago, and I don't know if it was my children getting older, because my daughter's 23 and my son's 21, and they were leaving home, and now I had a lot of time to do something. But there was a voice inside of me that rose up that I could not shake. And it revolved around hunger, and that's how I know Ted mostly, and poverty and the situation of the world. I also, when I go to this Sunday night group, I always get asked the question, why are you here? I mean, you know, what are you doing here? And the answer that comes up the really quickest for me is that I read a book in Hawaii. We went on vacation in Hawaii, and my husband couldn't get me to go play golf. He couldn't get me to do anything because I was reading And the Band Played On by Randy Schultz. So how many of you have read that book? It was the most incredible piece of political literary journalism that I ever have read. I was shocked. I was astounded. I was awakened in my awareness as many miles as there were pages in that book, and there were a lot of pages. And I was faced, I learned a lot about what AIDS was and what it wasn't, and I learned a lot about the bigotry and the bureaucracy and the hypocrisy that surrounded that disease, and the hypocrisy, how far it had spread before anybody started to take it serious. And so I think it was at that point that AIDS was no longer on the periphery of my life. I mean, it was right in my face. And so that's probably the biggest reason that I was there. Also because I care. Because I'm in the dance world. I'm in the theater world. I see my friends dying. I see them made pariahs and outcasts because they're ill, persecuted, and you know, marginalized. And that makes me really sad. I'm sad that there are people who suffer more from thinking about their illness sometimes than the illness itself. And that happens a lot. And I also have 2 members in my family who are sick. Well, one actually who's sick, and the other one who deals all the time with AIDS. And her name also is Susan Stauffer. And she's my sister-in-law. My name is Susan Ann Stauffer, and her name is Susan Stauffer. And little things happen, you know, just with that, because she's very active. She works with the Utah AIDS Foundation, and what they're doing is they send out dinners. And within the next couple of months, the Utah AIDS Foundation sponsors dinners, and it's at individuals' homes, and the food is donated, and you pay $20, $30, $40, $50, $60 or so to come to these dinners, and all of that goes to the AIDS Foundation. I have a group of high school friends that for 25 years we have gotten together once a month, something probably that only Mormons would do. But anyway, we get together once a month, and we have ever since high school. And so when Ted asked me to do this, and he only asked me to do it a week or so ago, and that's another reason why I'm fretting and not as prepared as I could have been. Anyway, so I was hoping to go to this group of women that I've known for 25 years and have a discussion about AIDS. Have a discussion with them like I'd been having with my bishops about what is the church's responsibility to people with AIDS. Or maybe the most, maybe the best question is what, or do they have a responsibility? Maybe that ought to be what we ask right ahead. So I was really looking forward to going to this group and talking about that. I walked in and, you know, I'd been sitting there and one of the women came in who I hadn't seen for a while, and she went, oh, she said, hi. She said, I saw your name on the dinners for the Utah AIDS Foundation. She says, I guess that you're working with AIDS. And I said, that isn't me. That's my sister-in-law. I said, my name is Susan Ann, and that's Susan. And I said, but I am working with AIDS. And she said, well, you know, my hairdresser is putting on one of those, or not my hairdresser, my interior decorator is doing that, and you won't find me there. I bet you he has HIV infection, and I certainly won't be going to that dinner. I mean, and I was just really disappointed. And I just said to her, well, that's really too bad. I said, you're probably going to miss a lot of good food. I mean, that was as outrageous as I could get. You know, and I felt bad about that. And then I talked to two of my best friends after, you know, about what I was doing. And we ended up having a kind of nice conversation about it. I told you I talked to two people in my ward who had family who died of AIDS. And the two stories are really a contrast. And you've probably all seen some of that. One of them, his brother, Alan, died in 1989. And he was in the hospital at one point. I hate to even tell this story. I mean, people say, no, this didn't happen. And they, both of these young men spent time in the hospital. They put this, Alan, when Pat went to visit him in the hospital, he was in the very back room somewhere, kind of way, way far away. The doctors and the nurses, you could tell, were uncomfortable. They were afraid of him. She happened to walk in one day when there was a nurse putting his food on the floor. And she just walked out. She's a great lady, with this woman to the nurse's station, and went, he's not a damn cat. She said, don't you even worry about taking in his food. You know, I will take it in from now on. And, you know, she told me a lot about the story and a lot about the sense of humor that her brother had while all of that was going on. And then there was Eric, who's the bishop in my ward, whose nephew died. And he said he went up to the hospital, and his experience was totally different. The nurses walked in happy. They walked in with smiles on their faces. They walked right over to him and embraced him, kissed him on his mouth, and loved him. And for him, it was a totally different experience. And I think the only difference between those two stories is information and education. And the difference, I mean, there's something called afraids, acute fear regarding AIDS. You know, and it's rampant. It's rampant out there. And it's very difficult, you know. I mean, I thought, if I came here, what can I really say what I feel? Can I really say what I think the church and the people in the church, what I think should happen? I mean, do I dare say that the church is making a mistake on its stand on homosexuality, for one thing? Do I dare say those things? And I just said it. So, you know, there's a couple of things that I've tried to do as a Relief Society president. Before I was president, I taught compassionate service. Compassion, you know, when I say I had this voice inside of me, I don't know where it's coming from. I don't know what it is, but it's there and it's screaming at me. So one of the first lessons that I gave was a compassionate service lesson leader. I'm not going to talk a long time because I know you have a lot, so I'm going to finish this up real quick. The lesson was on nurturing others with love. And so I thought, well, since I hang out with a lot of theater people and I'm kind of a dancer, I like to see a lot of movement in Relief Society, and I like to see a lot of drama. And so I thought, we'll do a little skit. And so I wrote a chorus, and I got a voice of hunger, and I had a voice of poverty, and I had a voice of a single mother, I had a voice of the ailing, and I had the voice of a homosexual, and I got some women together and asked them to do that, and about 5 out of the 10 people went, you can't have, we don't have a voice of the homosexual. You can't do that. And I said, who said I can't do that? And I said, I'll find somebody who wants to take that part. And I found somebody who wanted to take that part. And, you know, it was kind of a dramatic kind of thing of, you know, them walking. I started giving, how it started is I was standing giving my lesson, and I started giving, reciting a poem about love and how we succor the weak and the sick. And then this voice rises up out of the audience and says, you don't succor me. You don't take care of me. You know, and then I'm trying to finish reading my script, and another voice stands up and interrupts, and then they start walking around the room. It was really quite dramatic. And so, you know, all of a sudden the voice of the homosexual pops up and says, I am despised. And, you know, the other voices are speaking, and finally I'm starting to listen, and they're chanting, and we're walking around, and, you know, after this person says something 2 or 3 times, they figure out what it is. And I was really hoping that would generate some conversation, that somebody would say something. And we talked about poverty, and we talked about illness, and we talked about hunger, but nobody dared breach the other one. And so I don't know. I deal with those kind of things, and I think that we have a long ways to go. I sat and talked with Gary Billingsley, who is the other person who I consider a family member. He has known my husband longer than I have, and I've been married for 25 years. He babysat my kids when they were little, and he's sick. And he single-handedly runs the Utah Food AIDS Food Bank. And they feed like 90 families a week. At Christmas time, they feed some 250. You know, there are families that are being fed there. And he said, you have a welfare system as big as God, which I loved. And it's true. And these people have nowhere else to go. There's a lot of people in the church who have nowhere to go. They can't come to their Relief Society president. They can't come to their bishop. They don't feel like they have friends who they can tell. And this is a place that they can go. And Karen, it's a real shame that she isn't here, so that you can hear her story. And the Utah AIDS Food Bank is feeding her and her family of 7 because the church isn't feeding her. The bishop, her husband supposedly, he got sick from an allergy shot. And the Relief Society president told her she was lying. The bishop said, you must be lying. He couldn't have gotten it that way. And they did not let the son pass the sacrament. I mean, stories like this that you can hardly even fathom. And Gary knows her. You know, and I was thinking the other night, we all sat and listened to the sesquicentennial projects that we did. I wonder how many people doing their sesquicentennial projects thought about doing something with the AIDS Bank. Well, I asked Gary, my ward is taking food. We've got some things planned to help. And he just said, that would be a present, you know. He said, you know, that somebody in your church would care about these people. He's Jewish. He says, you know, if you think having this in Mormonism is tough, you ought to try being a Jew and deal with this, which I don't know what that means. But so I'm trying to do what little I can. You know, in those ways, when I hear somebody say something stupid and ignorant, like, this is God's curse, I mean, I can't stand it anymore. I was sitting in a room with the Stake Relief Society people and a woman in my ward who was talking along those lines. And they were all agreeing, and they were all going on that this is a curse in the latter day, and on and on. And my heart, you know, is just beating out of my chest. And I looked at her, and I said, it is exactly because of people like you, which is not a very nice thing to say, and people who think like you do that we're where we are with this epidemic today. And I mean, have you ever dropped a bombshell in a room? I mean, they all just kind of, stopped dead in their tracks, and they just kind of looked at me like I was a heretic, and I felt wonderful. I was just thrilled to death that I'd done that. So I think when we hear things like that, we can do it. I'm going to end my remarks with something that I did write, if I can read it. Ram Dass, what he says about compassion, I really like. He says that compassion is the quality of being in relationship with others in the intensity of their lives. And I really like that. I like that he used the word quality. And it's a felt kind of thing. It's an expression. It's not particularly something that we do. Now, if I can read this. I also want to read something from Creation Spirituality, Matthew Fox. Compassion is a kind of fire. Aquinas says compassion is the fire that Jesus came to set on earth. It disturbs. It surprises. It ignites. It burns. It sears. And it warms. Compassion incinerates denial. It especially warms and melts cold hearts, cold structures, frozen minds, and self-satisfied lifestyles. Those who are touched by compassion have their lives turned upside down. That is not necessarily a bad thing. AIDS has turned all of our lives upside down. It's shaken us, it's made us angry, it's made us afraid. It's given us an opportunity to explore love, to explore triumph and courage also. It's confronted us directly. Paul Kawata of the National AIDS Network in Washington said, "Those of a prophetic bent predict that AIDS and how we respond to it will define the latter half of this century in tomorrow's history books. History will show us to be either the great nation, or I would add, the great church that we have been in the past, a nation of individuals who tolerate one another's diversity and demonstrate compassion for their fellow citizens' misfortune, or a nation riven by fear and ignorance. How is it that we, as Latter-day Saints, will respond?" That's all I have to say.
I'm deeply moved, Susan Ann. If all Relief Society presidents could have that sense of compassion that she describes, then this world would be a totally different place and this church would be a totally different place. Our next panelist is someone who I have come to love like my sister, because we share lots of common things. Barbara Barnhart will share some of her own experience. Barb is an example of a light, someone who lives with conviction and compassion. Barb has her bachelor's degree from Brigham Young University. She is a nurse. She was a head nurse at two major universities. And if I were ever sick, she's the kind of person that I want to nurse me. Barb is a member of our support group. Fortunately, she hasn't been able to come very much because a couple of the times, whenever we have it, she's been ill. But I'm going to let Barb tell her story and share her experience of being a woman, a nurse, a person who is also an alumni of the Lord's University, and has AIDS.
Oh, and I hate standing up here in the front of these things. No, I'll be fine. you kind of have to bear with me today. I do this a lot, and it isn't very often that I get emotional anymore, and this is one of those days. It's been this way all day, and it just keeps getting worse. So you have to bear with me a little bit. I'm 28 years old. Until 2 years ago, I was the head nurse of three units in the University of Utah Hospital. And 2 years ago, my life was drastically changed. I had been sick for about 3 years. I went through nursing school at BYU, and nursing school does a lot of really strange things to you. It's very stressful. And I thought, okay, it was when I got mono for the first time I was in nursing school. It's just because I'm in school. It'll go away. Well, I kept getting sick. Oh, every few months. It didn't go away. The fatigue was always there. And the doctors kept looking at me and saying, you're a woman. I'd had very, very few sexual partners. I was not an IV drug user. I lived in Utah. You're fine. It's stress. It will go away. As one day, my staff and I had a staff meeting, and they talked about feeling like they were at high risk for HIV. We had talked about it. We'd done all the in-services. What AIDS was, what AIDS wasn't. And I felt okay about that. We did add yearly HIV tests to our staff. Well, okay, I proceeded to draw the blood and assign random numbers, so it was like a little confidential, you know? And it was a Monday morning that I got this huge stack of HIV reports on my desk, and the next to the last one was positive. And I thought, oh, this stupid lab, they screwed up so good this time. And then I looked up whose number it was, and it was mine. Now, that proved to me that lab was just way off, and it was really wrong, and I sent in a second sample. The second one was positive, the third one was positive, and the fourth one was positive. And by that time, I was starting to say, okay, maybe, just maybe, and I called my doctor. When my doctor did the fifth HIV test, it also was positive. And my T cells were at such a low level that by the new numbers, I already had AIDS. Looking back, I talked to my sexual partners. I called them. I said, listen, I just tested HIV positive. I don't know if you gave it to me or if I gave it to you, but get tested. All four of them tested negative. It kind of did a number on my head. I was like, oh, well, great. How did this happen? And looking back into my past, when I was a teenager, I was sexually abused. And the person who did that also has AIDS. So I've been infected since I was 16. All of the time, not knowing it. 10 years of not knowing it. It was a horrible blow. I can't think of anything more devastating than hearing you have AIDS to anybody. And that's not somebody who deserves it or who's an innocent victim. It's devastating to anybody who hears that. What more time can you think that someone would need to call on their religion and their beliefs and their faiths to get them through? I went to BYU. I was raised in a non-Mormon family. And when I was 16, life at home sucked so bad that I moved in with my best friend in high school. And her family was LDS. And I started going to church with them. I joined the church when I was 18 and went to BYU all 4 years. My faith was shaken a little bit when I moved to Utah and felt not very well supported. I've not been very well supported in having HIV. It's great. My ward in Billings, and I have a little one that I went to in Red Lodge, have been so cool. I mean, they call me about once a month to just check, so how are you doing? What are you doing? When I'm at home, I go to church regularly because they're wonderful with me. They don't treat me any differently. Real soon after I was diagnosed, I decided that it's time there was a woman out there saying, I have AIDS. Because there was this whole group of people saying, it can't happen to me. And I set out to change that. So I did a TV thing with one of the newses. And the bishop, four houses down from me, learned on TV that his neighbor had AIDS. Well, his kids had lived at my house half the time. I mean, I have this golden retriever that's 106 pounds that is the biggest baby you'd ever meet. He's wonderful. Those kids were down there playing with my dog all of the time. They stopped coming around, and I didn't think anything of it. I didn't connect it. Until on the way to school one morning, one of the kids saw me outside and said, "Oh, you're sick, huh? Well, that's how come I can't come see you." And so I had to investigate this a little bit. Talked to him. It turns out that their dad had said that they couldn't even pet my dog. Great. I felt horrible. I felt dirty. I felt toxic. And I'm not. I have become so spiritual. My faith is stronger than it has ever been in my entire life. But I don't feel like I have a support system that I can share that with. It's really hard. I talk to groups of school kids all of the time. I quit working very soon afterwards when I got an infection from a patient. Not that I was scared to take care of sick people for their sake, but for my sake, being around sick people was pretty stupid. So, okay, I quit work. So now I do AIDS education basically as my job, and I think that that's important. The kids out there have an incredible need and a desire to know. I hear all the horror stories. I know, yes, they're all the horror stories. I know that I don't hear the normal ones, but I do hear them. A ninth grader whose parents would not sign a consent form so that I could not talk about condoms to that class, who came up to me after the presentation and said, "But you know, anal sex is the only kind of sex that I can have because it means I'll stay a virgin. And it's only petting, and so it means I'll only be disfellowshipped. I won't be excommunicated." Oh, no. That was the myth that was in that school. I talked to the girl very extensively about condoms after I, you know, felt it out. "Can you go home and talk about it?" "No, my dad's the bishop. He'll kill me." Oh. I'm not saying that's the norm, but I am saying that that's out there. The other thing that I really try to teach to people is, how would you feel if you had to call your mom or your dad and say, "I've got AIDS, help me through this"? And how would that feel inside? And how would your family respond? Because I think that's really important. This is not a them disease at all. This is an everybody here disease. This is an everybody thing. And everybody's going to be touched by it. It's not discriminating in terms of religion or race or sex or anything. Everybody's going to be touched by it. And you have to develop some kind of a response. And I hope that it's a compassionate response. I hope that it's a knowledgeable response. There are so many people who are still afraid to be around someone with AIDS because they're going to catch it. And that's not true. It's really hard to catch it. But everybody needs this education. Everybody needs the 101 part. And I was so impressed to see so many hands go up. That's kind of cool, because usually one or two people will raise their hands and say, "Yeah, I've had that information." So this is probably maybe not the group that we need to hit. What I would urge you to do is, everybody who's here, take it to somebody else. Take this message to somebody else who does need it. I can't think of anything else. My mind's kind of gone today. So I'm going to let Ted talk, but we will answer any questions that anybody has.
I really don't want to take too much time, because I really want to leave time for some discussion, from insight from other people, from a chance to ask us whatever you want. We prefer not to ask how we got it, because that's kind of irrelevant. My experience with having HIV infection and how that has affected my life, how that has affected my interaction with people that I care about, my family, and what it means to me and other people. And I don't speak for everyone, but I can share the experiences. And somehow I hadn't became all that big a deal. And I suspect that I could put a big D on my chest and call it denial. And denial has actually killed more people than practically any other thing. I get so angry when I have friends who are in denial. They know they're positive. They don't bother to get any tests or blood work or anything, and they die, because they die not from HIV infection, but from denial. I started working in 1986 for the Utah Department of Health, and I was the director of the Supplemental Food Program for Women, Infants, and Children, which fits neatly into my whole thing to end hunger. So I fed a lot of babies and children and pregnant women in Utah, and my field is maternal and infant health. And I started getting sick, and a year and a half ago I had to stop working. But I'll just share one horror story that happened to me. And I worked for the Department of Health, and one day the director of the Department of Health called me up and said, "Ted, I need to talk to you." And said, "Okay, fine." It wasn't a big deal that she would want to talk to me, because I happened to run a major program and there were always things to talk about. And so I went over and she said, "This is about AIDS." And I said, "Oh, okay, fine." Because I had let my supervisor and other people know. I didn't wear a big sign. But, gossip mongers and word gets out, and I was sick a lot and people figured it out. And someone who worked for me had written a letter to the department, the director, asking what are they going to do about this person with AIDS in the building, and should they start handing out people. I noticed there were lots of supplies of these alcohol swab things in the bathroom. It's like, whoa, what's going on here? It was like I felt absolutely devastated. How could it be that people who work for the health department have such fear about this disease? And this was in 1989. What did people do with the Surgeon General's report? How many of you remember seeing the Surgeon General's message? You know, usually 60% never did. It still has some of the best information about what AIDS is and what AIDS isn't. So if you run across people that are ignorant and you can't think of anything else, give them that message, because it still is relevant and still is valid. Last year, I was invited to be the closing keynote speaker at the American Public Health Association meeting in Atlanta, Georgia. That's a national organization for about 40,000 members, of which I've been a member for a long time. And it was a great honor. And just before, someone said, "You have so much courage to talk about AIDS and your life and, you know, everything's out there." And it says, "The line between courage and sanity is very thin." And I kind of felt that way just before we started this thing today. But I have come to a sense of freedom. I don't have to pretend to be who I am not, and I don't intend to ever do that again. So I don't have to pretend at this point in my life. And one of the things I've learned from this virus is that life is too short to live a lie. I don't have to pretend that I don't have AIDS. I don't have to pretend that I don't have a testimony of the gospel of Jesus Christ restored. I don't have to pretend that I'm not a gay man. I don't have to pretend anything in my life. It's really a kind of a wonderfully freeing experience. I have to contend with the contradictions that I talked about earlier, but those are mine, and mine alone. I'd like to share with you something I said at this meeting, and part of it has to do with lots of people like are always asking, and just the other day my very first missionary companion happens to be in town, and after this I'm going to a 20-year missionary reunion, something I would not ever have done a couple of years ago. But, you know, I'm getting older and more or something. Anyway, I'm going. He said, "Well, do you have AIDS or do you just have HIV infection?" Which is something that common people ask, like, as if somehow there's a difference. Well, I just want you to know there's not a difference at all. The only difference is AIDS is a definition that the Social Security system uses to classify people whether you get benefits or not. It has nothing at all to do with the disease. And I'm going to quote something I wrote that I gave at this meeting in Atlanta. As scientists, we get so caught up in the fascinating epidemiology and pathology of infection itself that we lose sight of the human suffering caused by the infection. I recall early on in America that a virus was called HTLV-3. I recall at my horror at FHP here in Salt Lake City as an uncaring physician wrote that in a red pen on top of my lab slip as I went to have lab work done. After much debate, the virus was labeled HIV and finally HIV-1 and others HIV-2 and there's some other kind of who knows what. We then classify people with infection into categories and then change the categories regularly. How many people affected are made worse by the stress of waiting for the official word that they have full-blown AIDS? Now, this is a term I personally detest. It sounds like a balloon or a condom or perhaps for the inventive mind some deviant act. For those infected, it seems to me... other people don't laugh, but that's okay. For those infected, it seems to me that a simple well, not so well, yucky, way sick, and dead would work just as well as classifications and be less of a burden to both the medical community and the infected people. Now, Barb and I both know that we've been well, not so well, yucky, way sick. We haven't, either one of us, been dead yet, but real close on a couple of occasions. Close enough to know that being dead is not the very worst thing that's going to happen to me. Being sick is the worst thing. Dead is not a big deal. It's like going into somewhere else. And that's a wonderful comfort. While scientific taxonomy comforts the medical community with the illusion of control, it does little for the human being with HIV disease. It appears that we like to count things and classify them more than we like to work on ways to solve problems. We should spend more time and effort in educating and stopping the spread of the virus rather than count the bodies of those already infected and dead. It seems to be a cultural phenomena that we like to do programs rather than deal with human beings, a cultural phenomena of which the LDS Church has become a real important part of. The other part about the HIV epidemic is the interesting thing. It may be the first disease ever that the people who have it know more about it than anyone else. And this is kind of a statement about early in the HIV epidemic, bureaucrats decided that gay men were expendable and therefore did as little as possible for as long as possible to halt the spread of the virus. Fortunately, the gay community, comprised of a large segment of middle-class educated people, realized that silence equals death, a motto that fits this disease. The gay community has rallied to support and create their own prevention and education programs. Consequently, new infections in the gay community have decreased dramatically. We have rallied and protested and been arrested, and we have demanded changes. Just look at who is running and supporting most services for HIV-infected people. Activists, by default, have become administrators. But now the time has come for change. The burden and pain are too much. It hurts that so many of our friends have died. So now the time has come that America needs to respond. And there's this thing called America Responds to AIDS. It's about 10 years too late. It doesn't have any power. The President of the United States has yet to act on any of the recommendations that his appointed panel did. So we're still dealing with the fact that people are dying, and it just goes on and on and on. I personally am numbed. I mean, every week somebody that we know dies, and you just get numb, and that is not a good place to feel. The biggest pain I have about having HIV infection is the anguish that my parents feel as they watch their child become sick and ultimately die. And I want to share the thousands of tears I have shed with my children, Melanie, who's 15, and Shannon, who's 11. The pain of having two little children who depend upon me and have this horrible news. Imagine, if you will, the pain they feel when anyone talks about AIDS. Imagine their pain, especially when people joke about it. Their daddy is one of those people who have this disease. Last year, and I hope I don't cry, but last year, my littlest kid, they fortunately live in Colorado, which I'm really grateful for because they have a little more liberated education system and they have AIDS education as a regular part of their curriculum. But last year, they had AIDS education in the fifth grade, and people aren't very sensitive. And Shannon went home crying because, she recognized that her daddy was one of those people. They were talking about statistics. And I think it's time that you and all of us become compassionate human beings, and it's not about statistics, it's about human beings, and that's why people like Barb and I and hundreds of other people are willing to share our lives. Imagine how it feels to know that I may not be there for when my children get married. The disease has robbed me and countless others of many of life's opportunities. Remember the upward mobility of the 80s? I was like the yuppie of the 80s. My life is now in the downward mobility of AIDS. The loss of ability to work, the incredible expense of drugs and medical visits, the roller coaster ride of being one day well one day and sick the next and never feeling in control. The pain of being rejected, not for who I am, but what I have. And yet I am only one person. Multiply the pain I feel by millions. The whole earth is groaning under the burden of this pain. Hearts are broken and hopes are crushed. But as a tribute to those living with HIV infection, I wish to share my personal feelings about the power of healing and love. Among us, we have learned valuable lessons about living. I spent a few years dying my life. It didn't work for me. You know, like you're going to die any minute, and every time you get an infection, you're like, you're on the... And always worrying about your T cells went down another 100 or whatever, or that you don't have any, like some people. Mine happened to be okay right now, but I decided, it didn't work for me to be dying my life. I have really come to know that I am alive and intend to live my life. Recently, a friend asked me, "How long are you going to live?" You know, with that look. My response is always very easy. I intend to live until I die. How about you? A few years ago, I was able to put down on paper in kind of poetry form lessons that I learned from a virus. And I'd like to share with you those now. Music has a way of touching our souls, and most of us in the culture that we live in, music is a very important part of that. But music reaches way down into my heart and pulls out brightness and light. And the idea that a virus had taught me lessons came to me during a Mozart concert at Symphony Hall, and I wrote these on the edge of the program. And I'd like to share with them now. To live each day one at a time, emotional and physical agony beyond comprehension can teach us about our own capacities to live. Love and affirmation and compassion are the essence of humanity. Much of what we think is important, like the work or academic freedom, is really not worth dying about. We cannot be ignorant or passive about the health care we receive. We must advocate for ourselves. To be truly alive is to feel everything more profoundly. Lifting others up and showing them hope, even when there appears to be none, also lifts ourselves up. By ourselves, we can do nothing, but with friends, we can soar with the angels. Life is too short to live a lie. Simple things are the very best. Sometimes we try too hard and miss the real message of living. Did you ever know people who are like studying the scriptures and memorizing everything and they miss it? Over the head. They miss the essence. The gospel of Jesus Christ is very simple. Look up and live. Look up and receive the light. But no, we have to underline and all that kind of stuff. Light begets light. Faith and hope and charity are all that really matter. My God and my Savior make this burden easier to bear. An open heart is a greater gift than death is a tragedy. I may not have lived as long as some, but I will have fully lived. Henry David Thoreau went into the woods, and someone mentioned Dead Poets Society earlier in another conversation, but he went into the woods, and he wrote, I went into the woods to live deliberately, to seek out all that was not life, to root out all the very marrow of life, to root out and find out what life was, so that when it came to die, I will not discover that I had not lived. I have come to know that I may not live as long as some, but I will have fully lived. And with that, I'd like to just share that I know that we have incredible power, and I'm really appreciative of the opportunity to share, to talk about my own life, to not be able to have to hide behind any kind of barricade or any kind of thing, just to be, I can just be Ted, the born-again Mormon, gay, white, Christian male, who has AIDS. Thank you. Now, I'm going to take a little liberty and share the story of Karen and David Reed, since I don't think Karen's going to make it. But Dave Reed, a lot of people knew in the community. He worked, he was a person who taught school. He taught first grade for years and years and years. And for 15 years, he taught first grade. And the children loved him. He was a wonderful teacher and a wonderful friend to the kids. And then he was involved in financial planning, and he sold real insurance and everything. And he had six children and a wife whose name is Karen. And a few years ago, he discovered that he was HIV positive, and they were, why did you get this? And there were lots of speculations. And he had some kind of allergy shots that required whole serum kind of thing to happen. And as far as his physicians could tell, that's how he contracted the virus. And a lot of emphasis was on how did you get it, how did you get it, because people didn't happen to believe that particular story, and rumors, et cetera, happened. And what happened to that family is an example of what you can do so that doesn't happen ever again. If you happen to be active in the church and you ever have a chance to speak out that you can, you can be a voice so this doesn't happen. I just wrote this tribute to him the day after he died, and I'll just read it now because it really expresses kind of the experience that they had. A dear and sweet, humble man was buried today. He died from AIDS and left a wife and six children. The distress that the disease produced in his ward is an example of why changes need to occur. We must get accurate information to ecclesiastical leaders. Every person needs to know the fact and the fiction about HIV infection. He and his sweet wife experienced some unfair pain because of the lack of preparedness of the leaders of the ward in dealing with the issue. The family was shunned by some members of the ward. The oldest son was told by the bishop that he could not pass the sacrament because some ward members were concerned that they might get the disease. Almost at the very end of this man's life, he was persecuted. The bishop was trying to get him to confess that he really contracted AIDS through some unresolved sexual sin. Rather than offering support and love and sustenance during a time of incredible pain, some church members and leaders were adding to the distress. Had they taken the time to learn the facts, perhaps some of the pain this family experienced could have been eliminated. But now it's too late for that family. But with enough work, others will be spared of that. The bishop offered food, 2 gallons of milk a week for six kids. It turned out that the Utah AIDS Foundation fed the family for the last practical year of David's life. And someone had the audacity at a meeting, the bishop invited somebody to come and talk about AIDS. And at that meeting, to the ward members, the person said, the Utah AIDS Foundation does not deal with Mormons. Of course, Karen is pretty articulate, and she got, no, that's not true. And in fact, I said, well, that seems a little contradictory, since I happen to be an active member of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, and I'm the president of the Board of Trustees of the Utah AIDS Foundation. Why would you think that the AIDS Foundation doesn't serve Mormons? The perception might be that Lots of people hate Mormons. I think in this community you either are one or you hate them, or you just barely tolerate them. But there's reasons for that, because there has been a lot of prejudice and bigotry, and nasty things have happened to good people. I would like to just share my experience with the church has been positive. Why has it been positive? Because I've made it positive. I figured out, Joe, maybe I want to get back to the church. I have this testimony that didn't go away in spite of all I did to try to make it go away. I would go back to the church, and so I prayed about it, something that I always have done, and ended up in this, up on Capitol Hill, and went to my bishop. He didn't seem that interested, and I talked to the stake president, and I started getting a response. I went with love, and I got love back, and I have experienced the willingness for people in those positions to reach out if you give them an opportunity. That's been my experience. And it's been a long struggle. It's been little by little educating them to accept where I was and my willingness to live according to these rules. Now, whether the rules, the object of the game, someone said, is to win. And if you're going to win, you have to play by the rules. Now, this particular game that we're playing is, and these are the rules, and so I've opted to live by those rules. Now, whether I agree with the rules or not, or whether the rules can't change, is another question. I think the rules probably need to change, but I don't have the power to change those rules. But I do have the power to be an example of, just because I have feelings like this does not mean that I am not a person who is loved and accepted and embraced by the Savior, who has the power to change my life and make me perfect. So I've been rejected by friends. I've been loved by friends. Most of my friends, the people who love me most, one of my missionary companions, again, I have all these missionaries. Some people don't even keep in touch with their people who are missionary companions. This one happens to be a mission president now in Spain. When they found out I was HIV infected and all that kind of stuff, it was like, fine, come over and be part of our family. And that's what they simply adopted me again as part of their family. Other friends I've had, their children, like, they don't let me come and visit at their house anymore. So we experience rejection, not for who we are, but for what we have. And that's what we need to overcome. So that anybody who you know, how many of you know have somebody you know who has AIDS? See, that's why you came to this. But you have a chance to just be there for those people. And if they can't speak for themselves, get out there and speak for them. So we'll answer questions now. Yeah. Well, Marty?
I'd like to make a comment. That's okay.
Yeah.
I'd like to thank all these three people, Susan and Barbara and Ted. My experience with the church has been a little different, because I've worked with AIDS patients for 4 years, and the church has helped AIDS patients. In fact, in two or three situations, they have provided rent, furniture, food on a regular basis. But having said that, I feel like these three people, that there does need to be change, and there needs to be education among the members. I think it's the members that are going to change the leaders. Because, you know, when the 10 lepers came to Jesus, he didn't ask them where they got it. He just healed them. And one recommendation that I would like to make would be that I think we should have gay people as Relief Society presidents. Because it's been my experience that gay people are very, very special and very, very choice. And I don't care where they got it, if they got it, if they don't get it. I do feel bad that they have to suffer. Elizabeth Kubler-Ross wrote a book called AIDS, The Ultimate Challenge. And in that book, and she's not a Mormon, she said that she believed that people with AIDS come to this earth, choose to come to this earth and have AIDS to teach the world compassion. And I thought that was very special and very wonderful. And I just wish you to the best of luck, and hope that as individuals, you know, in our everyday life, just don't put it, leave it till Sunday in Relief Society. Right? Wherever we go in the marketplace, if we hear any negative comments, just be brave and speak up and say, I know somebody with AIDS and they're a choice. I know somebody who's gay and he's just, as, you know, there's too much emphasis on the difference between gay and straight. There's no difference. We're all children of Heavenly Father. And that's my comment.
Thank you.
Save me from having to repeat the question.
Right. It's not really a question. I apologize for that. But I want to thank you all for what you've said and what you've done. I was a little disturbed to read the abstract of this session when I read that a description of AIDS said it started primarily among homosexuals and HIV drug users, and now is spreading at an alarming rate among women, children, and teenagers. Where was the alarm when it was just gay men? While Relief Societies sit and spout platitudes and quote scriptures about compassionate service around the world, gay men only had themselves and each other to perform compassionate service. You're right, we can't wait for the church hierarchy to understand this. They're not going to. We can't say to the Savior at the last day, well, gee, I didn't do anything because it wasn't a church program. There's talk now, there's church members now and leaders beginning to pat themselves on the back because they're beginning to understand about the poor women and children and the, quote, innocent victims. It implies guilty victims. They're saying some deserve it and some don't. There are no innocent and guilty victims. They're just people who are suffering, and we have to do as the Savior would do. I want to share with you, in San Francisco, I'm a member of the San Francisco Singles Ward. In 1987, with the help of a wonderful bishop, and since then, a wonderful bishop who has succeeded him, the LDS AIDS Project was established because 30 to 35% of the San Francisco Singles Ward active priesthood was gay. And to this day is still about that percentage, 25 to 30%. Easily 50% of the inactive and active are gay. 50% of gay males in San Francisco are estimated to be HIV positive. It couldn't be ignored, and there was a bishop who recognized that. He appointed the ward clerk to be trained in AIDS education, to join the Interfaith Council on AIDS and represent his ward. The church wouldn't let him send him as a representative of the church, per se, but he sent him as a representative of his ward. The Relief Society president, who was at that time HIV positive and is still today, though she's no longer Relief Society president, is one of the longest living survivors of HIV, of a person who's HIV infected. She's also a nurse. The two of them together put together a training package, trained in a Sunday school class, trained home teachers and visiting teachers to be caregivers to people with AIDS. And that program has paid off. In 3 years as a home teacher in that ward, I lost 7 home teachees to AIDS. The ward has lost over a dozen. Some the ward never even knew. You might say, that's San Francisco. Of course, it happens there. But it's happening everywhere. And we can't wait for the church. We tried to share our program with the church. It worked in San Francisco. There were bishops around the Bay Area calling, wanting help. We gave as much information as we could. We wanted it to be a nationwide program. The church, the hierarchy in Salt Lake, didn't want to address it. They let us go on, fortunately. Didn't stop us. But It's not going to happen from the top down. I mean, we can't just sit here and speak in platitudes and quote scriptures. We have to get out there. You said we didn't come here to complain about what hasn't been done. We should be screaming about what hasn't been done. At the same time, we're doing it. There's so much more that could be said, but I won't take any more of your time. Thank you.
I just have to make a comment about what Marty, is that right, said. I have a roommate. She was a very good friend of mine who, when I was at the point of being sick a lot and not having any income after stopping working, she said I could move in with her. It's been so cool. I've been in the hospital, I think we're up to 24 or 25 times now in the last 2 years. Every time I'm in the hospital, there's this whole group of gay people who bring Sandy food, or who bring me real food in the hospital, because I won't eat that hospital stuff. They have taken such good care of me and my family, my Seamus and my roommate Sandy. Seamus counts. He's a dog, but he counts. They have taken care of everything that we need. There have been times that they've mowed our lawn. There have been times, oh, you name it, and they've done it for us. It's been so cool. And I guess on the innocent and guilty victims, that's one of the things that bothers me the most. I get called an innocent victim all of the time, and it's one of those things, oh, I hate it. Please don't call me a victim. If anything, I'm a victor, because I'm living with this and I'm doing a lot with it. And nobody deserves this, and I can't say that enough. Nobody deserves this.
I was just going to say, my paper did. I was screaming about what hadn't been done. There was a lot of that on there. One thing I didn't say, and one thing that I think has impressed me heavily, and I was nervous and I forgot to say this, is it in the discussions that I have had with people, I kept hearing, I'm worried about the kids. AIDS activists who are talking, they're not asking for sympathy. They're worried about our kids. They're worried about us. That's why Ted put this panel together. That's why she goes out and educates people. That's why the Les Miserables cast stayed in town and put on a fabulous benefit, because they cared about us. They're not screaming for attention for themselves. You know, I mean, we hear that out there. I wish they'd just be quiet. They're always in our face and they're always... It's because they are caring about us. That's why they want the education out there. That's why they want the talk, because it's us. This is an ugly disease. It's not pretty. And nobody needs to get it anymore.
Yeah, I just wanted to comment to Marty. The preface was that I didn't want to rage at you, but that we rage. The title of my talk at the American Public Health Association was Rage, Rage Against the Dying of the Light. And it really was about the rage I feel that nobody has done anything. It doesn't even matter. As a society, we did nothing. The Reagan administration is accountable for a Holocaust that killed 3 times more people by the time I gave my talk than had died in the Vietnam War. And we don't have a memorial to them. But I agree 100%. The reason I'm out here, like, we need to rage and we need to change the church, and the church has to change from us being able to deal with within and educate everybody that we can come in contact with. Gwen?
I'm not going to be inspirational or anything else like they have been, but I was away from Utah for 25 years, and then I've been home 4 years, and I've been working with the AIDS Foundation. And what Barb said about, we go out and give speeches to the kids in the schools where we can, and we hear some of the most startling things, like this little girl that said, I have to be a virgin. Okay, I start going twice a year to my extended family's family reunions. And all of a sudden I'm sensing from... I'm the top level, and then the second level, and then the kids. I'm sensing and hearing from the kids that they don't know what sex is about. Their parents don't tell them. Gods, that's what my generation was accused of. We didn't know how to talk about our kids. I'm on there too. Well, it's because I've made sure that this extended family of mine know about this. On Monday, August 24th at 8 p.m., there's a program on KUED, and it's what kids want to know about sex and growing up. And I've gotten this information to my kids, all of my extended family, and say, go and, do you call it Xeroxing it? Or, you know, on that thing? And then review it. And the handbook that goes with it that you can get says it's simple, it's facts, but over and over they say, look at it and then talk it over with your adult people and see what else you want to add. Don't just go saying, just say no. That's not going to work. If you want to, but first, I've suggested that they preview it because the parents are going to be, they're going to be embarrassed when their kids start asking questions.
It's done three times and it's already. Fantastic. It's a really great video.
Even the price of the video, it's not expensive. No one can afford to.
It's been on and it's really, really good. But, you know, I have to tell you, the kids know it's out there. The kids are the ones who told me about it. It was kind of an underground at the school saying, oh, there's this program on sex. It's on Channel 7. It's watchable. I mean, they knew about it long before the parents did.
Mm-hmm. Other questions? Oh, yeah.
I just feel prompted to tell you this story because I'm sure there's some temple goers in this audience. And I know of a young man who's gay whose parents have cast him off from his family. And they're temple workers. And I was so horrified when I learned that this family could turn their own flesh and blood away. And he recently attempted suicide and they still refused to come and associate with their son. How can you reconcile the teachings of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints with someone who goes to the temple on a daily basis? And I was so horrified by that, I did write to a general authority about it and said, how can we reconcile this? You know, this needs to be some teaching, you know, about... I don't think they should have a temple recommend, myself. But the reply I got, of course, did not, as always, go address the issue. Another thing that really horrified me a few weeks ago was Ted Koppel did a program on AIDS, and he was talking about teenagers and children and youth and about the sexual practices, and he said that, and it's probably a bit strong to bring up here, but he said that teenagers were practicing anal sex because if they were religious, they could tell the bishops that they were virgins and they didn't get pregnant. So it's what a lack of education in this country in every segment of society. And we've got to do something about it. We've got to get involved. And I was that when I heard that, I went to the hairdresser the following day and was talking to the, you know, I was having my hair coloured and this young, beautiful girl was asking me what I did, and I told her. And I told her about this program, and she says, oh, we all do that at the high school I go to. And this was a predominantly Mormon. Isn't it horrifying? I don't want to frighten everybody, but I just feel that these issues are so important, and I'm glad of the opportunity.
Thank you for coming. Remember that I have some stuff here. If you live in Utah, the AIDS... Utah AIDS Foundation hotline. Some new pamphlets we just published called When a Friend Has HIV Infection. and AIDS prevention guides and other stuff, which you may take with you, call anytime the AIDS Foundation, and be active voices in the circle that you live in. And if you happen to be active in the church, be active in speaking out and defending those of us with HIV infection, and being a voice for reason and a voice for education of children. If we could teach children, teaching children that they can have intimacy and they can have love, and that you don't have to have sex to have emotional and physical intimacy, that I think if we can get, if my children can learn that, then I've been a good parent, that you can get love and nurturing. Now, people have said, well, how can you be an active member of the church and be gay and all this kind of stuff? And it's like, well, because I get emotional and physical intimacy without having sex. It just happens to be the rule that they have currently applies to me in that category. But that doesn't mean I don't have lots of friends who are gay. In fact, most of my support network is, because we're the ones who have to take care of each other, because our experience has been that no one else wanted to very badly. So go forth and preach the word of God correctly.
The hottest room in the place.
We do. Because we're such hot people.
No, I'm sorry. I didn't even Jesse got a little
bit. I get it.
Thank you.